From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill are again the subjects of debate. After a 3-year investigation into the Thomas hearings, two Wall Street Journal reporters have revealed evidence that they say suggests Clarence Thomas lied under oath. On today's Fresh Air, we speak with one of those reporters, Jane Mayer. Also, we meet comedian Brett Butler, star of the sitcom Grace Under Fire. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Borderliners, a new novel by Peter Hoag, author of the bestseller Smilla's Sense of Snow. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton is spending the day stumping for Democratic candidates. He is stopped in Minnesota and Michigan and later will appear in Delaware. Mr. Clinton insists that once voters realize what he has accomplished in his administration, voters will decide to keep the Democratic working majority in Congress. Texas Governor Ann Richards is hoping to get a boost from her recent endorsement by former presidential candidate Ross Perot. Richards is in a tight race for re-election with George W. Bush, the son of former President Bush. Lisa Garvin of member station KUHF reports from Houston.
The paths of Democratic Governor Ann Richards and a Republican challenger George W. Bush will cross several times today as each tours Texas to get out the vote. Two major polls have shown the race to be too close to call, with Bush gathering a surprising number of endorsements from minority leaders in the last week. The key to a Richards victory appears to be getting reluctant Democrats to the polls. Bush will be getting some last-minute campaign help from his parents. The former president and first lady will appear with Bush at a noontime rally here in Houston. Richards has a Houston appearance at the very same time. Turnout at the polls is expected to be at 55%. For National Public Radio, I'm Lisa Garvin in Houston.
Authorities in a Cleveland suburb report several people have been shot and wounded by a man who entered a local middle school and started firing a rifle. City officials in Wycliffe say several adults were wounded at Wycliffe Middle School, including the suspect, but they say no children are among the wounded. A trial has started in Germany for one of two U.S. Air Force pilots who accidentally shot down two U.S. Army helicopters in Iraq last April. NPR's Deidre Berger reports.
Decorated fighter pilot Lieutenant Colonel Randy May is charged with negligent homicide. He and another F-15 pilot shot down two U.S. Black Hawk helicopters in northern Iraq, believing them to be Iraqi aircraft violating a no-fly zone. The U.S. helicopters were transporting an international fact-finding mission investigating the situation of Kurds in Iraq. 26 people were killed in the accident. In a statement, the 41-year-old pilot called the accidental shooting the result of a chain of human error. May faces a court-martial, dismissal from the armed forces, and up to a 26-year prison sentence. Proceedings are expected to last several days, with a final decision being taken by the commander of the 17th Air Force. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
A South Carolina woman accused of killing her children may plead insanity. Lawyer David Brooks says he's considering that defense for Susan Smith. Brooks says he's considering everything. Smith is charged with murdering her two young sons by rolling her car into a lake near the town of Union, South Carolina. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 2 1/3 points at 3,805. The Nasdaq is down almost 4 at 762. This is NPR. The judge in the O.J. Simpson trial has decided to allow cameras to cover the case. He turned aside his own anger over inaccurate news leaks and a stack of anti-media letters. Judge Lance Ito says news reporters have become more responsible lately, and any problems that occurred were outside his legal reach. He's put only one restriction on TV and still cameras. They must be operated by remote control during witness testimony. Ito had set today's hearing after angrily threatening in September to remove the cameras because of what he called inaccurate and irresponsible reporting. A new report finds the cost of caring for a patient with asthma can be cut significantly if the patient is treated by an allergy specialist. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
Most asthma attacks are sparked by allergies, but most asthma patients are taken care of by primary care physicians, not allergists. Doctors at an HMO owned by Kaiser Permanente wondered whether allergists could be more successful with asthmatics. So they sent 70 asthmatic patients being treated by primary care doctors to allergists and monitored their health. There was a 68% decrease in hospitalizations and a 56% decrease in emergency room visits when the patients were being treated by allergists. The researchers conclude that while allergy workups cost money initially, they save money in the long run and improve the health of the patient. The report was released at a meeting of the American College of Allergy and Immunology. This is Joanne Solberner in Washington.
Thousands of southern Europeans are cleaning up today after the worst flooding in the region in 80 years. Authorities say at least 63 people have died, mostly in northern Italy's Piedmont region. A weekend of heavy rain is beginning to let up. Italian officials say 20,000 firefighters, police, and volunteers are helping out during the crisis. Italy's government is promising emergency funds for the affected region. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Who told the truth, Clarence Thomas or Anita Hill? My guest Jane Mayer is the co-author of a new book that's reopened the debate. It's called Strange Justice, The Selling of Clarence Thomas. Mayer and co-author Jill Abramson are reporters with The Wall Street Journal. They researched the history of Thomas's nomination to the Supreme Court and investigated Anita Hill's charges that Clarence Thomas sexually harassed her when she worked for him. The authors conducted hundreds of interviews and read thousands of pages of documents, many of which were never previously shared with the public. During the Senate judiciary hearings, Thomas said this about Hill's charges: "If I had used this kind of grotesque language with one person, it would seem to me that there would be other individuals who heard bits and pieces of it." Now Jane Mayer's book documents the stories of several people who heard Thomas use crude language.
I guess that for me the most surprising thing about our research was that there were actually some people who had contacted the Judiciary Committee and volunteered to testify despite the fact that it was such a climate of fear and a hostile environment. In particular, we found a woman named Kay Savage who recalled visiting Clarence Thomas's apartment at the time when he was supervising Anita Hill. They were friendly. They were professional acquaintances, basically. She worked in the Reagan White House. What she found there surprised her, which was that the place had was decorated with a number of nude centerfolds of women, I guess probably from Playboy magazine, and a stack of Playboy magazines, 5 years worth of them, sort of very, she said, obsessively organized by date, month, and year. And she concluded from it that there was a public side to him and a private side to him. So she was willing, when Anita Hill was publicly questioned, to talk about this to the Senate Judiciary Committee. And she called up a staffer in Biden's office after she consulted a lawyer. And she thought that at least it seemed to her probable that Thomas might have said such things to Anita Hill about pornography, because it seemed to her that he was interested in at least sexually explicit materials. I don't know that one would necessarily think of Playboy as pornography, but, you know, it's a magazine about sex and nudity. At any rate, the Judiciary Committee in the person of Joseph Biden made a judgment call, which was that the American public was not going to stomach this kind of testimony. And in particular, I think Biden was afraid there would be a political backlash against the members of the committee for delving into these issues. So he indeed decided not to, and she was never called. In addition, there were a number of people whose stories reached the committee that also shed light on whether or not Clarence Thomas might have had some bits and pieces in his past that suggested there was a pattern of behavior on his part. There was a well-known Washington lawyer named Frederick Douglass Cook, who was the former D.C. Corporation Counsel, who recalled seeing Clarence Thomas with a what was described as a triple X video entitled "The Adventures of Bad Mama Jamma." It's a in the course of researching this book, Jill Abramson and myself, who are Wall Street Journal reporters ordinarily, actually got a hold of the video so that we could see what it entailed. It's a multi-sequence kind of movie about a 250-pound black woman who is engaged in various sex acts with various partners, male and female. It's not exactly. It's not. It's. I think a kind of a grotesque and a kind of humiliating movie, really. But at any rate, this man, word of him and what he had seen reached the committee also. And again, Chairman Biden just thought the American public is not going to want to hear this sort of thing, and there would be just too much of a backlash. And, you know, everybody, I think, by now realizes this book is quite critical of Biden. I understand it was a very difficult judgment call for him about where to draw the line. I think what we criticize in this book very strongly is he drew a different line for Anita Hill's life. In her case, experts were allowed to come on and suggest that she was suffering from some rare sexual disorder called erotomania, which would explain for her imagining these things that were happening to her when they didn't in fact happen. And people like John Doggett, who were men who she'd come across years before in her life, were allowed to come on and testify that in his case, he claimed that she had fantasized about him, which was, when you came down to it, on the basis of some crossword she'd said to him somewhere along the way years before. There was a double standard here, and it allowed Anita Hill to be caricatured and, I think, smeared, while Clarence Thomas's full character was never displayed in front of the American public.
Did you talk to Biden about why he didn't let the people who you referred to testify?
I did. And I want to say that, again, I want to emphasize, this is not a book by political partisans. We talked to everybody who would talk to us. We talked to many of the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee for the first time, and Joseph Biden explained that he was trying to be fair. There's a quote in this book from him saying, "I could have killed him," meaning Clarence Thomas, "with the pornography issue, probably with more justification than the kinds of things they were doing to Anita Hill. But I just didn't think it was fair." And then he said, you know, "In retrospect, I accorded him the fairness which he didn't deserve." I think, yet I also talked to Biden about whether he had major regrets, and he did not seem to, really. I would love to hear what he's saying now, but he's been declining interviews.
Now, you also interviewed Angela Wright, who says that when she worked for Clarence Thomas in 1984 as the head of the Equal Opportunity Commission's Communications Department, that Thomas pressured her to date him, talked about her bra size, said, "I really love the hair on your legs. I think hairy legs are much sexier." She didn't want to come forward and talk to the committee, but
she was subpoenaed.
Yeah,
yes.
How did they find her?
They found her because she was, at the time of the hearings, trying out to have a column at the newspaper she worked on. She was the assistant metropolitan editor, and she was auditioning to have a column. So she wrote a sample one up about Clarence Thomas after Anita Hill came forward. And it was just for her editor's eyes only, she thought. But the point of her column was, "I know this man. I know he's capable of the things that this woman is saying. You should take her seriously." And she said, "The reason I know he's capable is because he said similar things to me." Now, somehow, that sample column worked its way from her computer file to the hands of the Judiciary Committee. She has some ideas about who she thinks might have leaked it, somebody who was sympathetic to Anita Hill in the newsroom. At any rate, the next thing she knew, she was getting a call from the Judiciary Committee questioning her about her own column, which had not necessarily been written for the public. And she was asked if she would come to Washington to testify, and she said, "I will not." She had been in Washington. She'd worked for Clarence Thomas and been fired by him before. I guess it was in 1985. And she thinks of Washington as a political circus where the truth never has a chance to surface. And as she said to me in our interview of her, you know, "I knew from the start that they were going to portray me as some sort of two-headed monster." And the truth was they did. She went through a very thorough character assassination, even though she was never called.
Why wasn't she called?
Good question, because she had an awful lot to say. She spent the weekend in Washington. She was subpoenaed. She spent the weekend in her lawyer's office with her hair done and an outfit on ready to testify. And there was I think the best way to describe it is a massive failure of nerve on the part of the Judiciary Committee. The Democrats were afraid to get into these issues. I think they really didn't want to know the answer to this question of who Clarence Thomas really was. And I think the Republicans were waging a terrifically effective campaign to put him on the court. That's why our book is subtitled The Selling of Clarence Thomas, and it's really a much larger subject we're trying to grasp, which is the politicization of this whole process and the campaign to put him on the court. And they had a lot of power on their side. And I think that they managed to basically psych out the Democrats when it came to Angela Wright and scare them into not calling her Joseph Biden has said that he did want to call her and that he was the one Democrat in favor of it. But in our research, which again was talking to as many members of the committee as we could, nobody else remembers he or anyone else making an effort to call her.
John Danforth, who has been one of Clarence Thomas's greatest champions, said that if Angela Wright were put on the stand, she would have been incredibly discredited because she was fired by Clarence Thomas.
He said that then, and he's saying it still. I mean, I think one of the things that surprises me is the venom with which this campaign to undermine these women continues. It's baffling to me, really, that these people don't really want to know the facts. But the fact is she was ready and willing to testify, and none of the Republicans wanted to call her for the simple reason that, as one of them told us, it was clear that you have two women, you've got a pattern, this was spelled the end of the nomination, and they were not going to put her on. And, you know, she was not alone. I mean, her own credibility, I suppose, was questionable because, in the eyes of many, because she had been fired by Clarence Thomas. But at the time that she was undergoing what she said was similar kinds of comments from him at the EEOC when he was her boss, she confided this in a friend of hers, an older woman named Rose Jourdain, who's a very articulate and, I think, impressive person, who, though she had just been released from the hospital where she'd had surgery, was also waiting to go on to testify. And this woman was sitting at home cutting her painkillers in little bits and pieces so that she could remain coherent enough to testify and still, you know, not in so much pain that she couldn't come on. And she was also never called. You know, and subsequently there have been some of the senators have said, you know, if I'd known that Rose Jourdain was there and that Angela Wright had a corroborator, we would have definitely had her on. Or they've said, I would have voted differently. And of course, this was a terribly close vote, as it came out, the closest in history for a Supreme Court justice. Again, it was, you know, I think the American public feels that they knew what was going on in these hearings, but what we found was the hearings were moving very, very fast. People really don't understand how much was going on behind the scenes and how much information there was that the public never got to see.
Jane Mayer is my guest. She's the co-author of the new book, Strange Justice, The Selling of Clarence Thomas. Back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Wall Street Journal reporter Jane Mayer. She's the co-author of a new book about Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. How did Anita Hill first get drawn into the confirmation process? She did not come forward.
She didn't come forward. I think that's one of the myths about this whole thing. People ask, you know, why did she wait 10 years? Clarence Thomas had gone through all these other confirmation hearings. She must have been, you know, trying to ax him at the last moment when he was at the pinnacle of the edge of pinnacle of power, whatever. The truth is that when he was nominated to the highest court in this country, a friend of hers called up, and Susan Hirshner, and said, can you believe it? And asked her if she planned to speak out about it, and she said she did not. And we found, in the course of our research, a number of other people who spoke to her that summer who knew that to whom she also said she wasn't planning to come forward. But we posit, and, you know, again, that we are not apologists for Anita Hill, particularly though we do believe she told the truth about this, but we posit that she was somewhat ambivalent. I think she was really disturbed and torn. As a lawyer, I think she's got a very healthy respect for the Supreme Court, and she felt that Thomas's behavior was not befitting someone who should be there, but she also did not want to raise her hand and get involved in this thing. But because she told a couple friends, in the way that gossip travels, and particularly something like this that was going to be so politicized, the word made its way, we trace it in this book, from one friend to another to finally reach a liberal interest group, the Alliance for Justice in Washington, which then reported the information on to Senator Metzenbaum's office. Metzenbaum was known as a critic of Clarence Thomas's. And Anita Hill, I think, had no idea that, that this information about her was traveling to the Senate office until, in fact, a staffer for Metzenbaum called her at home. It was only then when the staffer called her directly and asked, "Were you ever sexually harassed by Clarence Thomas?" that Anita Hill finally answered. And we asked her, "Why did you finally tell the truth then?" And she said, "I felt I had a duty to report. My government was asking."
You write that you think there was some genuine misunderstanding between Biden and Anita Hill about her desire for confidentiality.
I do. And I think, you know, I think some of Biden's staffers were doing the very best that they could under very difficult circumstances. And it's, you know, easy in hindsight to criticize everybody. But I also think that Anita Hill was, again, ambivalent about what kind of role she wanted to play in this. This was a dangerous, dangerous position for her to be in. She's from the start. We got a hold of her very first lengthy conversation with a Senate staffer. We got a hold of the notes of this conversation. And what you can see is that she was worrying from the very beginning that she would be placed in some public spectacle where it would be her word against that of a man this accomplished and powerful. She didn't want to be in that position for understandable reasons. And so I think that she was going back and forth during much of this about whether she wanted to be publicly in a match against Clarence Thomas. And I think from our interview with her, it became clear that she thought that the committee had found other women or was looking into other women with similar complaints. So she thought that she was going to be part of a larger pattern that they were looking into. And I think when she realized that it was just going to be herself out there, isolated against Clarence Thomas, it was kind of a nightmare.
It was very odd during the Thomas confirmation hearings to have Anita Hill as a witness talking about long dong silver and a pubic hair on a Coke can. I mean, I don't think there's any precedent for testimony like this at a confirmation hearing. What happened behind the scenes with her aides and the people she was consulting with when they were deciding how explicit she should get?
There was actually a fight behind the scenes in that some of the older lawyers who were helping her prepare her defense thought that the sensibilities of the Senate would be very much offended by this kind of language. And in fact, a couple of the women who were talking to her about how to present her case, who were harassment experts, were urging Anita Hill to be as explicit as possible because they thought the American public should have to hear what she had to hear from Clarence Thomas, as she told it. And the issue was finally brought to Anita Hill because there was such a dispute in her camp about what to do about this. And Anita Hill sided in favor of explicitness, which is why the American public heard everything that it did.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jane Mayer. She's investigative reporter for The Wall Street Journal and co-author of the new book, Strange Justice, The Selling of Clarence Thomas. Let's go back close to the beginning of the Clarence Thomas story, the story of the nomination. You say that Thomas was nominated as a payback to the right. Who were some of the specific people or specific groups that, in your research, you found he was supposed to be payback for?
It was more of an IOU than a payback. George Bush was looking towards his reelection, and he was very nervous about whether he would get the support of the hard right factions of the Republican Party because he had already raised taxes against his promise not to. They were disenchanted with his choice of suitor as his previous Supreme Court pick. And so when Thurgood Marshall's seat became open, his chief of staff, John Sununu, called up Tom Gipping, who is a very far-right activist, and said to him, "Who do you want on the court?" And the answer came back in a fax from Gipping, who we interviewed for this book, saying, "Clarence Thomas." And from that point on, Thomas was at the top of the list. It was, I think, you know, a deal forged in electoral politics. I suppose that's not shocking to anybody who follows American politics, but it certainly did not ensure that the White House had looked carefully into who Clarence Thomas was or that they were particularly concerned with whether he was, as Bush portrayed him, the best qualified lawyer in the country to be in that slot. He was the best qualified political deal that they could get on the court, really.
During the confirmation process, there were a couple of African-American groups that supported him. You say that although these groups seem to have been grassroots African-American groups, they were actually groups that were created and funded by white fundamentalist groups that were working with the White House.
Yeah, I think this was one of the things that surprised me most. We would go and try to find out a little bit more about something like the African American Freedom Alliance, which was a spontaneous group that had formed to support Clarence Thomas, we thought. And what we found instead was that it was funded by white evangelicals who were being organized by the Bush White House. There were strings attached between these groups and the White House all over the place. And the White House was making a fairly concerted effort not to let these strings show.
Did you find out how or why these groups were created?
Well, I think that they were created because many of the far right and religious right activists saw Clarence Thomas as a sympathetic person that they would very much like to see on the court, but they knew they couldn't get him on the court unless they could win popular African-American support. And the way to get that was to portray Thomas as a backer of civil rights and somebody who was popular in the African-American community. So they had black fronts to white groups.
You point out in the introduction to the book that it's not possible that both Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas were telling truthful stories because their stories are so contradictory. After 3 years of research, do you feel strongly about who told the truth and who lied?
Well, I think we have to say that there's no smoking gun. There was nobody in the room with Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill, and this is true in most of these kinds of sexual harassment allegations. There's no transcript available or anything like that. But we do say that the preponderance of evidence favors Anita Hill. We found, after looking into her background, no pattern of lying on her part, no pattern of chronic imaginings of sexual attentions from people, and in fact, a fairly scrupulous record of veracity on her part. And when we looked into Clarence Thomas's past, what we found was a pattern of behavior that showed that he had a pronounced interest in sexually explicit materials and loved to talk about them to people. And, you know, some people found it amusing, other people found it bizarre, but you can go back from his college years on, right up through his period of working on the Hill, and even past that into the time when he was chairman of the EEOC, and find plenty of evidence that suggests that the behavior that Anita Hill described was not out of character.
The Clarence Thomas Anita Hill story has been so loaded right from the start, and some of the people who have come forward to speak about it found that there were attacks on their credibility and so on. And I'm wondering if you feel like you're in the middle of that maelstrom now.
I think it's a worrisome environment to come out with a book of fact in. I find that it's pretty hard for anyone to believe that you might actually have information as opposed to a political opinion. But, Jill Abramson and I stand by our records. We've been political reporters for the Wall Street Journal for a very long time. Nobody's ever accused us of partisanship. This book is absolutely loaded with new information, and most of it is on the record so that people can see where it came from. I think that the public ought to welcome some actual facts in this issue.
Jane Mayer, she's the co-author of the new book, Strange Justice, The Selling of Clarence Thomas. She writes for the Wall Street Journal. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When life gets painful, comic Brett Butler gets funny. Coming up, we talk with Butler about her life and her work. She's the star of the sitcom Grace Under Fire. She plays a woman who, like herself, was married to an abusive man. And critic Maureen Carrigan reviews Borderliners, the new novel by Danish writer Peter Hoag. His previous novel, Smilla's Sense of Snow, was a bestseller. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Authorities in Wickliffe, Ohio report one person has died and four people are hurt in a school shooting. Authorities in the Cleveland suburb are saying the death is that of a school custodian. There is no indication that any students were hurt in the incident at a local middle school. Authorities say that a suspect entered Wickliffe Middle School and opened fire with a rifle. Pennsylvania Senate candidates are spending the last day before the election campaigning across the state. Polls show the race between Democratic incumbent Harris Wofford and Republican Rick Santorum is a dead heat. Vicky Quay of member station WHYY reports from Philadelphia.
A statewide poll released over the weekend shows Wofford with a slight lead over Santorum, but others have put conservative Congressman Rick Santorum ahead of Wofford. With such a tight race and polls showing as many as a quarter of voters undecided, the two main candidates are keeping to a frenetic schedule. Wofford started early today in South Philadelphia, then began a statewide fly-around. Santorum is traveling across the state with Republican Senator Arlen Specter. Turnout tomorrow may be more crucial to Wofford. Analysts say he needs a large boost from African-American voters and suburban women. For National Public Radio, I'm Vicky Quay in Philadelphia.
Seven instructors at the Naval Training Center in San Diego are under investigation for alleged sexual harassment of women trainees. Allison St. John of member station KPBS reports from San Diego.
With the events of Tailhook still fresh in the public mind, the Navy may have another sexual harassment scandal on its hands. Fresh allegations have surfaced from women trainees at the Naval Training Center on Point Loma. The charges involve verbal and physical abuse over the past 18 months. More than a dozen women learning to operate computers and telephone networks at the Internal Communications Center say that trainers demanded sexual favors in return for passing grades. All seven of the trainers under investigation have served in the Navy for at least 6 years. A Navy spokesperson says if found guilty, they almost certainly will lose their jobs. In 1991, dozens of women say they were molested at the Navy's Tailhook Convention. For National Public Radio, I'm Allison St. John in San Diego.
Haiti is very close to endorsing a new prime minister. The Haitian parliament's lower house is expected to back Marc Michel and his ministers today. He won a vote of confidence yesterday in the Haitian Senate. Michel's economic recovery program for Haiti calls for reduced tariffs, increased exports, and privatizing many poor state industries. Michel says Haiti is now in a state of grace, but it must work quickly to take advantage of the hundreds of millions of dollars of international aid. On Wall Street, stock prices were mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than a point to close at 3,898. Declining issues led advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. A new study says many of the nation's acute care hospitals are not fully prepared to handle the rise in the number of elderly patients. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
1,300 acute care hospitals were surveyed during the study, and according to the results, only 5% of them indicated they were highly prepared to handle an aging population. Study says that people over 50 consume almost 65% of the health care in the U.S., and the number of Americans age 50 and older will grow to 96 million by the year 2010. The study found that hospitals are making contingency plans to handle the growing number of elderly patients. 34% of those surveyed said they have a plan or are making plans to form a strategic project to deal with aging. Many of the hospitals say they've been focusing instead on how to respond to the changing economic conditions of the healthcare industry. Dr. Robert Butler, chairman of the Department of Geriatrics and Adult Development at New York's Mount Sinai Medical Center, says hospitals have to be exceptionally attentive to the baby boomer generation. He says the oldest of the boomers are now 47. 3 years from now, they will be in the 50-plus age group, and one out of every five Americans will be over 65. I'm Greg Peppers reporting.
Crews in Indiana continue to search the crash site of the American Eagle commuter plane. Officials say they will recheck the muddy field to make sure they haven't missed anything, particularly clues. 68 people died a week ago when the plane crashed near Roselawn, Indiana. Investigators are trying to gather all the human remains and take them to a nearby morgue. Memorial services for the victims are planned tomorrow at a church near Chicago's O'Hare Airport where the flight was headed. Another service will be conducted in Indiana. Thousands of U.S. troops on duty in Haiti and Kuwait could be home for the holidays. President Clinton has apparently signed orders returning nearly all 7,800 ground forces from Kuwait by December 22nd. Another 6,000 troops are to return from Haiti by December 1st. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Grace Under Fire is now number one in the ratings. Brett Butler stars as a single mother and recovering alcoholic recently separated from an abusive husband. That wouldn't have struck most people as the perfect subject for comedy, but Butler had already built some of her stand-up comedy act around her own related problems. The creators of Grace Under Fire discovered Butler through her stand-up act. In fact, the character of Grace was written around Butler's life, although Butler, unlike Grace, has no children. The first joke in the pilot about her subliterate husband came right out of Butler's act. I asked what other parts of her life she brought to the character of Grace.
Basically, that she was a blue-collar, literate, very iconoclastic, satirical, who happened to have been in a relationship in which she was physically abused. And I have fought hard for the fact, you know, to make her also someone who was in recovery from alcohol and chemicals. It's real touchy there because everybody thinks in Hollywood, they go, oh, I don't know, somebody's done that. And I couldn't care less who did it. I don't care if Larroquette or Sharon Gillis or Mr. Magoo was sober, that I wanted to do it in a way that was just, you know, kind of like show the dailiness of it without you couldn't have a sitcom with a mom, like, you know, passed out on the floor with a baby crying. But who knows, maybe that'll be next. But I wanted that to be part of her too, you know, that it's not just a struggle once you put the bottle up, it's kind of a struggle to live humorously and sober too.
Is that something you don't... Go ahead.
Basically, she's me. The character Grace is me, except they had to justify my existence with the presence of three children.
Mm-hmm. So how much have you made the former marriage on the series like your marriage used to be?
It couldn't be that way. I was battered badly for 3 years, and I don't find it amusing or anything. And when they were talking to me about making my character a victim of abuse, I said, as long as it's in past tense and you show her go through the decision-making process of, like, putting her life together. I've read a lot of reports that said I based my stand-up act around my first husband. That's not true. No one would have listened to that. I probably did 5 minutes in a one-hour show about him. And it's been the choice of focus since I got a TV show based on someone. And since we have brought him back as a character this year, Grace's ex-husband, I think we've redeemed the choices that they both made somehow. Like, Grace can look at him with compassion, if not altogether forgiving him periodically. And, you know, I've said this before, and I know it's a really heterodox opinion about domestic violence, but I was battered, so I'm allowed to say it, in that, you know, I was so screwed up and young, and so was he, that if I had been a man, I'm not sure I wouldn't have done the hitting. That was just the game that we played at that time. So in this sense, I'm really glad we gave a human face to this, you know, butt of jokes, which I fought with last year. The former executive producer of the show, was the one who really did some of the most... I believe that every time you man bash, it makes the woman seem that much smaller. And I hated some of the stuff that we did.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah, just making him continually, like, you know, ignorant and inbred, and just, you know, some of the crueler references were things that Grace would say actually in front of the kids. And I think it's just really important that she not do that. My mother was, my real father left when I was 4, and my mother never said anything bad about him. And she basically let his absence be all that indicted him around us. And I just think that's really positive. You can tell your best friends things, you can tell your shrink things, but you don't take stuff out on your kids.
I want to play an excerpt of an episode in which there's flash flooding all around, and the ex-husband stops by to make sure that you and the kids are okay, mm-hmm. and then he tries to convince Grace to take him back.
I've stopped drinking. Mostly. And if I had a really good reason to, I'd stop altogether.
Mm-mm. You're not pinning this on me. This is your thing.
Well, sure. But if I wasn't drinking, then I wouldn't be raising my hand to you.
Well, you know, it never was the raising of the hand that bothered me, Jimmy. It was the contact. How'd I know your aim just wouldn't be better?
I just did that because I didn't know no other way to win an argument.
Well, that's funny. Got to where the only way I thought I could win the argument was to get you to hit me. So there we are.
Would you explain that line for me that Grace says, I thought the only way I could win an argument was to get you to hit me?
I look at my role, because I can only speak about my situation, you know, but I have spoken with other women who've been, you know, former victims or participants in domestic violence. I do choose the word participant. I don't have kids. That must be even worse. I mean, that it is worse. It must be infinitely worse to have, like, a financial burden placed on you and, you know, where you're going to survive with your children. But in my case, the word win is an ironic choice of words, and there's probably, I won't use the word humor, but there's kind of satire in that. The only way you could win a fight, in other words, what was going on was such a pathetic dance of power. All relationships are power struggles, and in domestically violent ones, they become even more so in a literal way, that anybody who bullies someone else or imposes their physicalness over them, they lose the fight spiritually, morally, scientifically, every single way you can think of. They lose. They just do. And they know that no matter how righteous they feel at the moment of striking out, they lose. And it is kind of a form of power. We're also, and plus the person who's the victim knows somewhere in the bargaining, and none of this was conscious when it was happening to me, by the way. And I, you know, there'd probably be women who would argue with this. The woman, the recipient or the victim, knows that you're going to be the recipient of pity and kind of apologies and making up and that kind of thing. You know, that was a way of getting some power for a powerless person.
Did when you signed up for Grace Under Fire, what was the character? Someone who'd been beaten by their husband?
They based the whole thing on me.
Right. So that came with you.
The only thing that was there when I got there was kids and a single woman, and the rest of it was me.
My guest is Brett Butler, the star of Grace Under Fire. She has a Showtime comedy special this Saturday. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Brett Butler, the star of Grace Under Fire. I know you grew up in Georgia, and you had 4 sisters. Your father left when you were 4. And you've described your mother as poor but cultured and left-wing, and mm-hmm. agnostic in the middle of the Bible Belt. Mm-hmm. Was your family considered eccentric?
Sure. Yeah, but most of the people who would think of us as eccentric did not have that word in their vocabulary. You know, godless Butler girls might really be more apropos.
Now, did you take that to heart?
No, I was really straining at the bit. I mean, sometimes I did. You know, being poor, you know, there's no such thing as a class struggle when you're poor. There's not a struggle to it. It's just a sense of feeling inadequate continually. We didn't have a father. We didn't have, you know, we were in like a, you know, free lunch program. You always kind of felt second best. And ironically, the ones to me who contributed to making us feel that way were the ones who were the most religious. So I came away with a real distaste for wanting to join anything, be it a, you know, a church or a group. I remember I begged to be in Girl Scouts. And after like 2 weeks there, I told my grandmother, I'll kill myself if you don't get me out of this. You know, I just, I didn't like it. And I came from parents who were kind of iconoclastic and didn't know exactly what to do with it. I mean, my mother was just so, if you look at her wedding picture, this is the greatest example. 1957, Atlanta, Georgia. My mother's hair was like 2 inches long and a feather cut. Like, and I asked her, how did you have your hair cut like that when all the other women had those lacquered bouffants? And Mom said, well, I saw Gina Lola Brigida with a haircut like that in a fashion magazine. And my mother had a Nehru collar wedding gown without an inch of lace on it. You know, I mean, this was like a silk dress. She looked like something from, you know, 1969 or 70 in the middle of all these, you know, bonnet-haired women. It was so bizarre. I mean, she was just, I mean, and I know that's just an image that I'm relating, but the fact that she wasn't afraid to dress like that or be like that when no one else was basically tells you how I was raised.
Now, I know when you were 16, you were on your own. I believe your mother was very sick.
Mm-hmm.
So what did it mean to be on your own? Did you live by yourself or what?
Yeah, you know, I'm just, after a year of doing this, you know, I just really, unless it, you know, people think it's like really important for people to know about this, you know, quasi-tragic life I've had, I wonder why people are so curious about that. Of course it was not fun to be alone when I was 16. Can you imagine how that feels? You know, I'd love to tell you I started up my own business, I was making $40,000 a year, and parents, who needs them? But that's not what it was like. It was pretty grim for me. I was well on my way to drinking alcoholically by then and living a life that you would kill yourself if your own daughter led. I consider that an adequate answer.
How does it feel different to talk about the rough spots of your life now as compared to if, like, we were talking about this 5 years ago when you were doing a lot of comedy, but you weren't really very well known?
I'm just incorrigibly honest about things. I really am. But nobody was interested in it 5 years ago is the only difference. And I'm glad this didn't happen to me when I was any younger, because I've really been making peace with myself from, you know, like emotional damage that I had. I didn't just, you know, live this like, you know, pick a daisy, skip down the street life before I entered that marriage in which I was battered. It took a lot of years to, you know, build that kind of person who would allow those things to happen. It took years after that to recover from it.
You had said to me before that you didn't want to be a celebrity poster child. And I'd like for you to try to... put your finger on what that is and why that's so disturbing. You know, what the phenomenon is and why you don't want to be a part of it.
Well, I already am. I never wanted to be on a sitcom either, but look how quick I said yes. I never did want to be on a sitcom, by the way. I turned down every other audition. I wouldn't go up for them. I said, nope. They're going to make... I didn't live in L.A. I lived in New York. I was trying to make my bones. I'm afraid, you know, by being that, I'm participating more in the illusion. You know, it's America. It's a really media-strong country where media rules and people do believe things they read if they read at all. And you know that. I mean, we've just really gone downhill. And by doing that, I'm afraid that, you know, why couldn't I be just some interesting woman unto myself without being so totally connected to my past as my image? But maybe people will get tired of it or something. You know, it's one reason I really envy and admire and feel for Roseanne, because she just beat everybody to the punch about everything that's ever happened in her life. She's like, well, you know, okay, fine, you're going to write that about me? Well, here's something you never thought of. Plus, I still am a product of the South, where it's sort of, you know, considered rude to talk about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you know, there's people who are in my family, not close to me, not close relatives like mother and sisters, but there are people in my family that didn't know this stuff happened to me until they read it in a damn newspaper.
I'm interested in your early days when you were developing as a comic. You moved from Georgia, where you grew up, to New York. And I
Georgia to Texas. The reason I'm mentioning
Texas
is because it was hugely important. I started comedy in Texas, in Houston, Texas. I did not start in Georgia. And I've compared it to this. People who don't live in the South don't really understand that I would draw these distinctions. But in Georgia, it sort of was like, I waited tables for a long time. And they go, well, sugar, you want to be a comedian in that precious. Now go get me some more coffee. And she the cutest thing. But in Texas, it was like, hell, girl, you want to do comedy? Great. Now get me another beer. I mean, it was still very man-centered, very macho and kind of that. But the Confederacy didn't mean as much to them. Women's roles didn't. Houston, when I moved there, was the oil boom was just ending. But there was a real free-spiritedness to the place. And where my humor was not considered threatening, where my outgoing kind of tomboy nature and the fact that I read books were not viewed as these, you know, bizarre facets on this untoward woman. I felt much more accepted in Texas.
In your new Showtime special, you talk about getting breast implants and you say that you're the only person in Hollywood with bleached hair and fake boobs who complains about how phony Hollywood is. Why'd you get
them? It's a joke.
I know, it's funny. It's funny.
Why'd I get them?
Yeah.
Why do you think I got them?
Because you wanted larger breasts. Am I right?
Bingo. Yeah. Yeah. Because I just was so convinced that my being, my whole being was incomplete without breasts that matched the largeness of my wishes. I don't even have it. There's nothing else about it. I mean, it's this. Barbara Walters sat me down to do an interview and said, Brett, weren't you concerned about the operation? Why did you do it? And I said, if you can look me in the eye and tell me I'm the only broad in this room who's had stitches, then I'll answer your question. You know.
Okay. So just one more question on this. Do you try to wear clothes that show them off?
I don't know. Have you seen me on the show?
Yeah.
On Grace Under Fire? Does it look like I do?
No.
All right. So when I go out on weekends, maybe I will. You know.
Now, you're,
look, I'm also, I like being 36 years old and being good looking when I want to be. I'm not beautiful, but I like it. I'm about as good looking as I need to be. I'm interesting. I'm asymmetrical inside and outside. And I like it. I don't have any apologies for it. I mean, you know, I feel pretty good about it.
Brett Butler, she's the star of Grace Under Fire, and you can see her do stand-up in her new Showtime comedy special this Saturday night. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on this night before the election?
Well, we have lots. We'll be hearing from NPR reporters from all over the country who've been covering election races all around, hearing about the outlook for tomorrow, which appears to be possibly a momentous day for the Republican Party. It seems very possible the Republicans could win a majority in the U.S. Senate, even possible that they could achieve the far more difficult aim of winning a majority in the U.S. House of Representatives. We'll hear from our reporters how they might do that and in what states. We'll have a story as well on the Oklahoma Senate race and on political money, where candidates spend it.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When Smilla's Sense of Snow was published last year by Danish writer Peter Hoag, lots of critics hailed it as one of the oddest and most compelling mysteries ever written. Its setting, which ranged from the snowy streets of Copenhagen to the Arctic ice caps, was a departure from the usual mean streets and manor houses of most other mysteries. Hoag has just written his second novel called Borderliners, and critic Maureen Corrigan says it takes readers into a more familiar but no less disturbing territory.
This is the kind of mystery Borderliners is. It opens not with a corpse in the library, but with a deadly question. The first sentence reads, "What is time?" Now, this metaphysical riddle is so cosmic, so fathomless, so potentially boring that I fear for the life of any novel that sets out to solve it. But Peter Hoag is the writer who not only made me aware that Greenlanders have something like 4 zillion words for different categories of ice, he also made me want to learn them all. What Smilla's Sense of Snow did for ice, Borderliners does for the much more mind-numbing subject of time. If only Immanuel Kant had had the good sense to write The Critique of Pure Reason in the form of a thriller like this, we'd all be a lot smarter. The narrator of Borderliners is also named Peter Hoag, a fact which sounds more significant than it is in the world of this novel where everything's strangely off-kilter. Bit by bit, the fictional Peter describes the childhood he almost didn't live to complete. He was an orphan raised haphazardly in Danish foundling homes and reform schools. Along the way, Peter learned to pick locks, hotwire cars, and stoically endure the suicide deaths of his frailer schoolmates. But Peter's most bitter lessons in the random cruelties of life commence when he's transferred, at around age 12, to Beale's Academy, a secluded boarding school for gifted students. Peter can't figure out why he's there. As he tells us, he's of average intelligence, and even that was probably stretching things a bit. Beale's is a sadistic place that makes Dickens' Gradgrind Academy look like a Montessori school. For survival, Peter bonds with two other misfits who have practical reasons for sharing his own philosophical obsession with time. There's a girl named Katerina who needs to pierce through time to find her dead parents. And there's a psychotic boy named August who's murdered his parents and therefore struggles successfully to blot out time. August explains to Peter, "If you remember and have a past, then you can be given the blame and punished." Peter and Katerina, who are more stable types, retaliate against the brutality of Beale's by spying on their teachers. Together, they discover that everyone at the school is caught up in a menacing, time-sensitive experiment to change human nature. As with Smilla's Sense of Snow, the plot of Borderliners, while suspenseful, really provides the necessary excuse for us to sit transfixed and listen to our narrator's dreamy voice. Translator Barbara Haveland deserves some of the credit for the alchemy by which Hoag transforms adolescent perceptions into poetry. Reflecting on the mystery of human personality, Peter sadly acknowledges, "Katerina, and maybe every person, was like row upon row of white rooms. You can go together through some of them, but they have no end, and you cannot accompany anyone through all." Borderliners is a more brooding, painful, and claustrophobic novel than Smilla's Sense of Snow. It's as though after luring us out onto those glaring Arctic ice scapes with Smilla, Hoag decided his readers needed to go back inside and adjust their eyes to the darkness.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Borderliners by Peter Hoag. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Kathy Wolf and Nancy Updike, research assistants from Becky Cohn. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked.
The poems and songs of Allen Ginsberg have just been collected in a new CD box set. Join us for a talk with Allen Ginsberg on the next Fresh Air.
Angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night.